Welcome back. We have the opportunity of going through. This is really a third part of a series, and each part of the series is an incredible perspective. I personally, just exploring it, has been really a remarkable perspective on our nation, on what it means to be Jewish, what it means to be a nation in general. So today's topic is ingredients of nationhood. We're going through the parashas of Shmos, what it means to be a nation. So this week we talk about the notion of empathy. This is a really important value for a nation to have in order to be afforded to be a cohesive nation. We'll take a look at some perspectives in just a moment. We're going to start off by thanking three families who are sponsoring today's shiur. First is to Rosemary and Irwin Fish, who are sponsoring for the Refuah Shleim of Mordechai ben Tzipora Malka and Shendel Bas Rachel. The Refuah should be Karova Lavoy, and it should be a Refuah Shleima Be'ezras Hashem. Rosemary, we're davening and we're continuing to hope to hear good news Be'ezras Hashem. We are also learning today, and we thank Naomi and David Kasowitz, who are sponsoring upon the fifth yahrzeit of David's father, Mr. Gabe Kasowitz. We remember fondly Gedalia Yitzhak ben Shmuel Yosef Olav Hashalom, whose fifth yahrzeit will be on the 10th of Shvat, and also David's grandmother, Mrs. Sarah Kasowitz, Sarah Bas Gedalia Aleha Hashalom, both who have very special namesakes, who Mr. Shem will continue to bring tremendous good and light into this world, and bring nachas to the neshamas they are named for as well, Be'ezras Hashem. And also want to thank Tibby and Ali Schwartz, who are sponsoring today for the yahrzeit of Tibby's father, Aaron Ben Yaakov Shalom Olivar Shalom, whose yahrzeit is also on the 10th of Shvat, and in whose name much, much Torah and incredible things are being done in the world and the community. Baruch Hashem. Nishmosai Eden. Let's jump straight in. We actually start off at a very obscure place in the storyline, a very obscure place in the entire story. This is a story which is not much studied, and perhaps it's because it's the end of Sefer Shmuel Beis, and perhaps it's because it's such a difficult story to read. But it requires a little bit of resilience to get through the story. So here we are told, and if we're going to assume that it's chronologically accurate, meaning to say that it's the right, this place that it actually occurred in life, it follows a whole slew of difficult times in David HaMelech's life. David HaMelech has a rebellion at the hands of his son Avshalom. There's a civil war waged against his son Avshalom, and he wins, but ultimately his son is killed. David HaMelech is very much in pain over that. He returns to Jerusalem only to be attacked by another pretender to the throne, Sheva ben Bichri. They are able to quell that rebellion. And now he's finally returning. It's been a very difficult time for David HaMelech. There's been the attack of his daughter Tamar, the killing of Amnon at the beginning. Just one thing after the next has been very, very difficult. And so after all this, now David HaMelech has to contend with this very interesting episode. Here's what we have. So let's take a look at it. It's only 14 psukim long, and it gives us the platform to understand a very crucial aspect of what it means to be Jewish, ironically. Oh, and a special, special mazel tov to Esther and Baruch Weinstein on Ben's engagement last night. What a special, special mazel tov, Mitzvah Shem. And it should be even happier than last night, which is saying a lot. So Mitzvah Shem, she continued nachas. Let's learn. We got it just in perfect timing. There's just a couple of extras over here. So we hear that there's a famine. The famine in times of David. Vayihi b'ra'av b'mei David. Shalosh shanim. Shana achrei shana. Vayivakesh David es p'nei Hashem. There's a famine. The famine lasts 3 years. Now, you know what it's like in Israel. We feel it. You really feel it. You really feel the pain of missing the rain. If the rain's are late a few weeks, a few months, when people are talking about the inch by inch of the Kinneret, right? You're feeling the pain. Imagine 3 years, there's just not been rain. Agriculture, it's an agricultural society, everything's suffering. And so he turns to Hashem. Vayomer Hashem, El Shaul Vel Beis Adomim, Al Asher Emis Es Agivonim. There's a castigation against you because of Shaul HaMelech, because of the house of blood that he killed the Gibeonites. Vayikra HaMelech LeGivonim, Vayomer Alehem. So he called these Gibeonites. Vayivonim Lo Bivnei Yisrael Hema. They're not Jewish. They're not part of the Israelite nation. Kim Yeser Emoriyeh Ubnei Yisrael Nishbu Lohem, Vayivakei Shaul HaKvason, Bekanoso Bnei Yisrael, Bnei Yehuda. So they had an oath of protection, and yet they were killed by Shaul when protecting the house of Israel and Judea. Vayomer David al Givonim, Moeseh Lohem, Uvameach Aper Uvarchu Es Nachlas Hashem. I know that somehow something's not right, so we need to fix it. You need to tell me how I can fix this so that we can have rain again. Vayomeru Lo HaGivonim, they're hard dealers. So listen to this. Vayomeru Lo HaGivonim, Ein lano kesef zav im shaul vim beisai. No amount of money is going to fix the problem. Vein lano ish lahamis v'yisrael. We don't ask for the life of any Jew, any Israelite. Vayomer me'atem mo'atem onrim eselochem. So what can I possibly give to you? Vayomeru al ha'melech ha'ish asher kilanu v'asher dimo lanu nishmadnu mi'yisyatzei b'chol gvul Yisrael. There was one person who hurt us, who decimated us, who killed us. And who is that? And that is Yutan lano shivas anashim ibonav. Give us seven of the children of Shaul that we can hang them, because ultimately it is him who caused us so much terrible pain. The king says, I will deliver them. So he saves Mephibosheth, the son of Yonatan, who he had a very close relationship. He spares Mephibosheth. Remember, Mephibosheth is physically challenged. Remember, he's eating off David HaMelech's table. He spares him. However, he takes two children of Ritzpah, five children of Michal. It's not actually Michal because Michal was his wife. Refers to, as the Mephoshim understand, as Merav, as we'll see later on in the Pesukim. That's Shaul's other daughter. So he takes two and five of the children, he hands them over. And they hang them, they kill them. And they killed at the beginning of the harvest season. This is this terrible, just this tragic scene, this image. And Ritzpah is the mother of the two of these children. She takes a sackcloth and she spreads it across the rock. And she chases away any of the birds or the animals to touch the bodies of her children. And he hears about what happens with the Ritzpah. It's a long story, who she is, why. There's a lot of background to who she is. If you remember that Shaul and Yonatan were killed in battle, and the Pelishtim had taken their bodies and hung them from the ramparts of Beis Shan, which is a Philistine city, then the people of Yavesh Gilad, who had a close relationship, they were the children of Bnei Ephraim, on the transjordan, went in a night mission, went and removed the bodies of Shaul and Yonatan and buried them in transjordan. David HaMelech now reinterred them in the appropriate place. Vayal nisham es atzmos Shaul ves atzmos Yonatan benoy vayasvu es atzmos amulkaim. He took their bodies and the bodies of the children of Shaul vayikvaru es atzmos Shaul Yonatan benoy ba'eretz binyamin betzela vekere kish aviv, and he buries them in their ancestral burial ground. This is the end of the story, and what happens is that Hashem allows the famine to end and everything goes back to regular. It's a shocking story. It's a terribly sad story. A lot of things to think about here. Without getting too involved, because there's not a Tanakh shiur right now, but it is worthwhile noting just a few interesting pieces. Rav Amram Bazak has a very beautiful perspective on this. He says that if you notice that there seems to be a theme of the word shavuah and shivah. You notice that there's seven children and there's an oath. There's a few oaths that are going around. Let's just go backwards for a second, who they are and why we got to this situation. When the nation of Israel arrived in the land of Israel, they were told, according to the classical approach, that they have to obliterate all the seven nations. However, the generally understood approach is they have to bid for peace first. They can't just come in and kill everybody. They have to say, on our terms, meaning to say, if you want to make peace with us, you can make peace, but you have to renounce your paganism, and you have to, and you're going to have to pay taxes. That's the way it works. So it turns out that there was one nation. It seems that although they're described as the Amorite, which is an umbrella term, they seem to be part of the Chivi. The Chivites, and they hear about the nation of Israel coming in. They hear about the unbelievable battles at Jericho and Ha'ai, and they say, "Hey, we're not in for this." So what do is they make this. There's this whole subterfuge. They dress themselves up as if they're from far away. They pretend that they've traveled in from Africa, and they say, "We're this faraway nation. Make an oath that you won't hurt us." So you're, without looking too much into credentials, you see, in those days the social media profiles were harder to access. Right, you couldn't just work out where they were recently with their kids on vacation. So it's harder to see who they were. So they took them at their story. They saw that they had these, worn out shoes, broken pieces of bread in their in their satchels, and they said, you know what? We'll make an oath. We'll look after you. Then suddenly, word comes out that they're from just over from over the hill, right? They're actually a Canaanite nation. They're one of the Canaanite nations, a very powerful city, and they already made the oath. So what do you do now? It's under false pretenses. They didn't understand who they really were. But Yeshua says, nonetheless, we will honor the oath of Hashem. We made it with Hashem's name as a whole nation. We'll honor it, and we'll make you, because of your dishonesty with us, we will make you in society water drawers and wood hewers. Right? So they're going to be a subservient part of the nation, but we're going to protect you. It's interesting to note.
You have to honor it. It was too subservient. Why? You have no reason to honor that.
Good question. It's a really good question. So it seems that when you use the name of Hashem and a nation uses the name of Hashem, there's a great gravity to that. It's not taken lightly. And the Givonites were playing on that. They knew that they would be discovered. They were playing on. They were hoping on this. And Yeshua honors that. He honors that Shavuah, and he protects them so much so. Just in case you want to follow up on the story, you move into the later chapters just after this in Sefer Yehoshua. What happens is that the king of Jerusalem says, "This is nonsense. Givon was a big city. Givon had a lot of warriors. This was not nonsense." They go into attack Givon, right? Because they say, "We're going to obliterate these turncoats." And then Israel comes to their aid and actually defends them and fights an alliance of five kings. There's a very remarkable battle that takes place after that. But Israel actually honors that Shavuah not just by not killing them, but actually by protecting them, right? So there's an internal warfare in Israel because of this. Fast forward many years, now we have this whole situation of the Givonites. And apparently Shaul has treated them badly. Why? Hard to know. But it's interesting here that what happens is it seems that Shaul, for whatever reason, Shaul may have good reasons as to why it was that he maimed them, but he was not so respectful of the same Shavuah. Isn't that interesting? And Shiva of his children were taken back. It's interesting in Shaul's life in general. Shavuah is a complicated issue in Shaul's life. For instance, he says that whoever tastes food on the day that he's going into battle, the Philistines will die. Who tastes food on that day? Yonatan, his own son. He says Yonatan should die because he says this is a Shavuah. And the people say, no, it's Yonatan, his son. It was a mistake. He didn't know. He was the one who won the battle. Then later on, he says, Shavuah, I'm not going to kill David. But then what does he do the next day? He throws a spear at him at the wall. So his relationship to a Shavuah is complex. Shaul's relationship to a Shavuah is somewhat complex. Whereas David HaMelech, if you sort of put him at the other end of the spectrum, is a person when he swore to Shimi ben Gera, and he says that, although you cursed me, a terrible curse, I'm not going to kill you, he didn't kill him. At the end of his life, he told Shlomo, this is what happened, I can't do it. Maybe you should be clever. There, but later on, when he made a shvuah to whom? To Yonatan, I'm going to make sure that I'm going to look after you and your children. Right here, as he's honoring the shvuah, essentially a protection of the Givonites, he's also honoring the shvuah he has to Yonatan. So David HaMelech seems to be very, very respectful of Shua. Shaul HaMelech in general seems to have a mixed relationships with the commitment that was made through a Shua. And this seems to be sort of coming to a fore in this story right here. But that's sort of a broader theme to think about as well. Another broader thing to think about before we get to the crux of the issue is that the Abarbanel says that perhaps the reason why this actually comes chronologically at this point in time is David HaMelech has suffered immensely in his life. David HaMelech has suffered. In fact, his wives and his children have suffered. Why? Because of a sin that he committed. The Bat Sheva incident is Shmuel Beis Perek Yud Aleph, and every interleading chapter up till now, up till Chaf Aleph, has been suffering for David HaMelech in his life, in some quarter of his life or not. And David HaMelech has the rightful question, says Zabar Benel, why should they suffer? So Hashem says, let me tell you something. Shaul's action has an impact on his children, and it has an impact. By the way, this is a 40-year interlude. 40 years later, the children are still held culpable for that sin. He says, yeah, you should understand that his action was against even an Israel, a non-Israelite nation. You, who sinned against an Israelite, how much more so? So part of it is a response to David Melech's own theological questions as well. A.B.
This is just a question. I mean, like, you know, we always follow neither connected neither, right?
Yep.
My understanding is that, you know, the sin is more about, you know, Melvira Kohanim, that they lost their...
Oh, yes, we'll get there in a second, yeah. Oh,
okay, they lost their ability to make a living, you know. How is that neither connected, neither, you know, like, to take the death of, you know, the children.
Good, yes, yeah, so there is more to this than the Misa'ah. Let's jump straight into the Gemara, because now we read the text. Now let's read the subtext, right? So Chazal provide us a little bit of the background to this. Yes,
Chaya. Maybe it also goes back to what you said in Aliyah Yomi, with the Gavia.
Oh, good.
Him, that it goes back to a way earlier Shua.
Interesting. Very interesting. Good. I like it. The point is well taken. Thank you. That's my mother's point. So coming back to this to this idea. I'd like to come back to it because actually there is another aspect of this that I think we know but we don't realize is connected as well. Sabi?
Isn't there a concept you can give up people?
Oh, good question. Yeah, well, you know, so when you're dealing with Urim V'Tumim, apparently it's a little different. Meaning, so we'll see in a second, this seems to be like Hashem was articulating that this was the solution. It wasn't David HaMelech saying, I'm going to, and this is, no. This seems to be Al-Pi Hashem, which is what makes it much more intense as well. Let's take a look at the background. This is a famous Gemara in Yevamos. The Gemara tells us a very important lesson that's learned from this, but it also gives us the subtext and context for the story. So we shift forward into source 3, where the Gemara tells us, starting on Ayin Ches Amud Beis, going into Ayin Ches Amud Aleph, Omer Rav Chana bar Adon Nesinim, David Gozar Alem Shenemar, Vayikra HaMelech LeGivonim, Vayomer Alehem HaGivonim, Lo Bibnei Yisrael Hema. So he says, this nation that we're talking about over here, this story is not just an inconsequential story about a tragedy. This, in fact, is a halachic story, says the Gemara, to tell us the status of these people. And therefore, when the Torah said, when the Nach said, Lo Bibnei Yisrael Hema, it wasn't a description, it was a prescription. Wasn't David Melech saying, by the way, those Givonites, they're not of Israel. This is David Melech saying, they will not be part of Israel. They will not be part of Israel. Why? Now, that's the continuation of the Gemara. My time, oh, Gozar Aleim. Gozar Aleim, why did he make this decree? Desiva Yira Obime David Shalosh Shonim, Shana Achar Shana. So now, here's the subtext. Shana Rishana, after the first year of famine, terrible thing in the land of Israel, Amalahem, Shema Oivde Avodah Zorah Yeshpochem. He said, I read Kriyashma every day, right? And if we don't serve Hashem, then we serve a pagan deity, then there's not going to be rain, right? So he says, okay. Says, anybody serving Avodah Zarah? He does a thorough research, sends out the police forces, checks intelligence, let's taps the lands, no Avodah Zarah. Right? So he says, that can't be it. So he does the research on the first one. By the way, notice, he's not blaming anybody else, right? He's not blaming the Jordanians, and he's not blaming the economy. And he says, well, what are we spiritually supposed to do about this, right? That's the Jewish response to things. Shana Shnia, so the second year, Shema Yesh Ovri Avera Yesh Bochem, Tichsiva Yimnu Revivimil Malkosh Lohoya Meumetzach Ishazona, Lohoyaloch, Ubad Kovloi Mazel. So he turns to the Pasuk in Yirmiyahu. By the way, Yirmiyahu not written this yet, but the concept was certainly around. Right, that maybe this perhaps relates to immorality in society. Maybe that's why we're not getting rain. And he said he found that society was acting in a moral way. Shlish is the third year. Maybe there are those who make pledges in public for tzedakah, and they don't give it. Whew, this is very heavy, folks. Very heavy. So it talks about, this is again over here as a pasuk in Mishle, where it talks about a person who makes a praise. Ish misalel b'matas sheker, a person who's getting, we'll call it glory from a false promise, right? So people say that they're going to do things and it doesn't really happen. By the way, I'm hoping that this is moving in the anticlimactic sense, meaning to say David HaMelech is looking for more and more, we'll call it lesser known averas, so to speak. But nonetheless, he still can't find that. So he says, if something's going on, there's something wrong in society, and it seems that society is all right. So what's happening here? So Omar, Ela Davar Ela Tolo Ela Bi. It can't be about society. It must be something that I need to fix, says David HaMelech. That's very unusual to hear a leader say. You will never hear this on Twitter. Never. Okay? So I've looked into this problem, and I realize that actually, in fact, it's my problem, my fault. No. That has never happened. So he then searched Hashem. So he searches, he speaks to the Urim V'Tumim. Notice he doesn't go to the Urim V'Tumim first. He first does the necessary inner work. So one thing he said, Hashem says, is you did not treat Shaul HaMelech properly. You didn't give him a hesped. Now, by the way, David HaMelech did do a hesped to him when he killed the person who murdered Shaul, who was already in the process of dying. But David HaMelech did give but it wasn't enough. Which is why at the end of the whole episode, that's why David HaMelech goes and reinters Shaul because he feels there was a disservice to it. Where does this happen? So, Abi, as you said, when Shaul HaMelech destroyed the city of Nov, which was the city of Kohanim, which is where the Mishkan was residing, it's as if he killed them. because they were supplying more food and water to them. Now, just remember a little bit of background. David HaMelech is now a refugee. He's running away from his father-in-law, Shaul HaMelech. Shaul HaMelech is trying to get David HaMelech at all costs. David HaMelech seeks refuge in Novir HaKohanim, which is where the Mishkan is residing. That's why it's a city of Kohanim. And when he's there, he's praying to Hashem. Happens to be there's a very firm fellow next to him who's also Davding. And his name is Doeg Adom. He happens to be Shaul's advisor. And he goes back and spins a yarn to Shaul and he says that actually Novir HaKohanim is supplying and helping and aiding and abetting David HaMelech. Shaul HaMelech therefore summons a tribunal because why is David HaMelech keeps escaping? He keeps slipping through the net. And without giving Achimatzin the opportunity of a real defense, he sends Doeg in who sees us and they massacre. Can you imagine this? The city of Kohanim, the place where the Mishkan is, because David HaMelech, they supplied food for David HaMelech. The Gemara says that somehow that relates to the Givonim as well, because they were supplying water to them. Who's the them? Rashi says it's because the city of Nov were the suppliers of water to the Givonim. So now you cut the pipeline, and now they no longer have it. The Maharsha says no, it was the other way around. The Givonim, in fact, were the food suppliers to Nov, Ir HaKohanim. So therefore, if you kill the buyers, therefore you're killing the market. Once you kill the market, they no longer have a commerce, and therefore, it's essentially dooming them to death as well. Now, as Abby points out, it seems a little too detached, right? See, if this is the accusation, it seems very much like a grumma, right? And a secondary causation. However, just to add a few little pieces here, in which other Mephoreshim say, in addition to the Gemara, could it be interesting point is the following. Where is it that the Mishkan moves to after Nov? Does anybody remember the name of the place where the Mishkan moves to after Nov? Givon. Is that interesting? Do you know most people say that the Mishkan goes to Nov and Givon, right? You take it for granted. Givon, of course, now it's a Jewish city. That wasn't a Jewish city. So how's the Mishkan there? The answer is, they weren't there anymore. How weren't they there? Answer is, Shaul HaMelech must have killed them to put it there. Now, Shaul HaMelech had probably reasons to do this, but understand that when the Mishkan moved from Nov to Givon, Nov was after Nov was massacred. How did it get to Givon? It's probably part of that same massacre. Just to appreciate the background of that movement, which we take for granted, right? That's what must have been happening. Why? Again, the Mephoreshim surmise. We don't have all the proofs, but it could also be that. Remember, Givon or Sin are always this complicated entity. They're on the fringe, right? They're not Israelite. They really have allegiances with those who live in the land. And now we're fighting wars against Plishtim, and they don't come to the Battle of Michmash. So they don't join the Israelites. Shaul HaMelech says, I'm not sure about these folks. And so he perhaps he pushes them aside. Perhaps he kills a bunch of them because he feels that they are turncoats themselves, like they were turncoats in the first place, against their own nation. Whatever the reasons, Shaul HaMelech feels justified. Nonetheless, they are affronted, they are hurt, they have a debt to collect, and they're not willing to forgive it. The Gemara goes on to say in the next sentence, Amar David, Shaul nafka le treisa yarchi shata v'le darka nemispede. David HaMelech says, look, it's been a long time. Shaul HaMelech has been, it's a while that there was no hesped for him. Nesinim nikrinu v'nefasinu, so he calls up the Nesinim and says, maybe I can fix it with them. They didn't respond to that. So therefore, so the Gemara concludes with an important line. And this is the line that we are trying to get to in our learning today. Amar, David HaMelech says, Shloisha simonim yesh bu'umazu. There are three signs, there are three hallmark characteristics which have to be part of the nation of Israel. Rachmanim, they are people who are merciful. Baishanim, they are people who are shameful, bashful. Gomle chasadim, and they are kind. Rachmanos, tichsiv, v'nosanacha rachamim v'rechamecha. That means even when the nation of Israel has to kill the city of Ir HaNidachas, a city which is so polluted spiritually that it serves Avodah Zarah, and still Hashem says, I'm going to supplant the rachamim that you had to miss by doing this cruel act. That Hashem's fear should be on your face, that you should have a sense of shame. If you see a person and you don't know that they're Jewish and you see that they have these characteristics, you should check because perhaps they are in fact Jewish. That's what the Gemara says. That's how far it goes. How is this connected? What's David HaMelech saying? Let's pull the full loop of the Gemara together. He's saying, I'm speaking to you, I'm begging to you, I'm begging with you. You understand there's a drought over here. We know that the drought is because of a sin that the nation, the leader of this nation did against you. Have mercy. Let bygones be bygones. Why are you holding on to this? Why are you holding this debt, this spiritual debt, which is now causing the nation to suffer? And the only way to resolve this debt is by you getting pious, by you getting appeasement, which is going to be the death of these children. And they weren't willing to relent. So David HaMelech says, Givonim, loy mi bnei Yisrael hema. That's, they don't have what it takes to be the part of the nation of Israel because they do not have that basic characteristic of Rahman. You cannot enter the people. I'm going to give what you're demanding because God is agreeing with you. The drought is because of this debt, and the only way to resolve this debt is this way. This terrible cruelty. But nonetheless, because you're not willing to have Rachmanus, you're not part of the nation of Israel. And that became the hallmark, which the Gemara says is learned from this as well. By the way, just as an interesting aside, the Maharal says in this Gemara, you see that these three characteristics are actually, in fact, the reverse of the Avos over here. So he describes how the when it comes to Rachmanim, where did I put the Maharal? Oh, here we are. The Maharal says, if you look at each of these things, each one comes from one of the forefathers. Yaakov shemidosa minasa rachmim. We see that the kel shaka yitelocha rachmim. So that Yaakov's idea, Yaakov's characteristic was that of mercy, as Hashem was promised to give him mercy. Yitzhak yira, which is busha, which is shame, and Avraham Avinu gminas chasadim, which means to say that each of these characteristics are inherited from one of the patriarchs in their own way. And what's being said over here is that if you lack them, then perhaps you're missing something in this nation. So much so that David HaMelech says, that if you see a person who doesn't seem to be Jewish but has these midos, then you should check and say maybe. Let's look into the genealogy. Let's see if we can find their characteristics, and perhaps they're part of the nation of Israel as well. It is worthwhile noting that. So we'll stop here. So now let's take it one step further. So how far does this go? Is this just an idea, or is this actually practical? So the truth is that there are practical applications of this. So here's an interesting example. The Gemara tells us in Beitza, Daf Lama Beis and Beis. The Gemara says a remarkable story. The Gemara seems to sometimes have an axe to grind on Babylonians. Sometimes you'll see the Babylonians don't always get a good rap. So the Gemara says, "Omar Rav Nosan Bar Bar Abba Omar Rav Atire Bovil." That's whenever you look at Aramaic, the word the letter Taf is usually supplanted for the Hebrew letter Shin. So Atire Bovil means Ashire Bovil. Those who are the rich men of Bovil, Yorde Gehinom Heim, they are going to the netherworld after this life. Kiha De Shabtai Bar Marinos. Like that fellow whose name was Shabtai Bar Marinos. Not a good fellow. Why Ikla Lebavel? Bami Nail Iska? So Shabtai Bar Marinos came to Bavel and he requested help of the Babylonians. So it's not about him, it's about the people he spoke to. He came to the city and he said, Can you give me a job? They said no. They said, can you at least give me money so I can have a stipend, something to subsist on? They said no. They weren't interested. Babylonian community weren't interested in helping him. Omar, hani me'erev rav ka'asu. He says, they must not be really Jewish. These people that who are representative of the community in Babylon, probably not Jewish. Why? Dechsev, v'nasen nacha rachamim v'rechamecha, kol ha'me'a rachim el abriyos b'yadua shu mizara shel Avram avinu, v'kol shmi she'ein ha'me'a rachim el abriyos b'yadua she'en mizara shel Avram avinu. If there's something so basic as Rachmanus missing, then you can say to yourself, this is the opposite of what David HaMelech was saying. David HaMelech was saying, ironically, is if you find somebody who's got these characteristics, check if they're Jewish. He is saying, if you see that they're lacking these characteristics, suspect that they're not Jewish. That's how important it is to this nation. So much so, the Rambam says in Hilchos Yisrobiya, when it comes to Shidduchim, the Rambam says in Source 9, Kol Mishpachos Becheskas Kashrus, Umutol Yisrael Mehem Lechachila. You don't have to suspect that a family is not Jewish. If there's no we'll call red flags waving, and you assume from family is a Shomer Torah Mitzvah. You don't have to say maybe, right? Rama says everybody starts with what's called a Cheskas Kashrus, that we assume that they are Jewish. Nonetheless, Imra Isa Shtei Mishpachas Shemitagras Zubazu Tomid. If you see that two families just can't get themselves out of the trenches against each other, they're just fighting all the time, relentlessly. Or Isa Mishpachas Shei Balas Matzo Meriva Tomid. That's just they keep fighting with everybody around them. It's an amazing thing, when somebody says, I have a problem with my neighbor, and then they come and they say, I have a problem with my other neighbor, and I have a problem with my boss, and you realize that it wasn't the neighbor, and wasn't the neighbor, and wasn't the boss, right? It's there's something else going on here, right? So you have that kind of family. A person who's very brazen, very difficult. Not only is that just not a good idea because it's going to end up having, it's going to be very hard to negotiate the wedding, forget anything else afterwards in an apartment and anything else. But you have to worry, says the Rama or Pastor, means to say that there's something wrong here. The person who's always criticizing other people, there's a person who goes around, you know, disqualifying other people all the time, saying they're not really Jewish. That's such a person themselves. You have to worry that maybe this person themselves, but Mumma Paisal is talking about their own things, right? So, and he goes on to say that, to all these ideas. And he's skipping a line. A person who's extremely brazen, a person who's cruel, a person who he's not willing to be kind with other people. Maybe they're a givani. Why givani? Because that's the hallmark what David HaMelech was dealing with in this particular story, says the Rambam. And that's what we learn from the givanim. And therefore, if there's missing these things, one should be concerned not just because this is a difficult family to get involved with, but because these are hallmark characteristics of what it means to be Jewish. Complicated arena today. We have enough reasons to have difficulty in Shidduchim. So I'm not sure how halachal ma'aseh this is. But this is how far it goes. In fact, Rav Melamed, in his Sefer Panina Halacha, says it goes further than that. Not only is it a concern we'll call it in the family tree, it's an intellectual deficiency as well. So his example is in the Likutim, says in Nesos 10, Eina Torah kachochmois hateva. When you learn Torah, it's not like you're learning physics, you know, biochemistry. You can be a very corrupt person and be an extremely good physicist, right? And we can name a few, right? So it's very possible to be a morally corrupt individual and to learn a lot of Torah, to learn a lot of science. The Torah is the way of Hashem v'alkein. It's impossible to really accept it, to absorb it, if you don't have the right emotional, intellectual preparation. What is preparation? That means being a moral person, being a person who is a good person. So he says, the reason why this nation was chosen was because those are the prerequisite characteristics to be able to understand Hashem's Torah, because it wasn't just like getting the, you know, physics 303 lecture under the belt and getting a good pass in that exam. What it means is, in order to be able to understand this information, you need to have these characteristics. That's how far it goes. Not just in terms of our genealogy, but in terms of our intellectual ability and emotional ability to absorb the Torah. That's how far it goes. Remarkable story. Let's trace it all the way backwards. So where does it come from? So the Maharal says it goes all the way back to the fathers, right? But I would say that it goes back to the original story of how the nation unfolds. And that is the beginning of Sefer Shmos, where we hear this. We have a slave nation. We have these people in Egypt. And we hear about the following incident. We hear about Moshe Rabbeinu, who's this complex character. He's got a little bit of Egyptian, you know, culture. He's got a little bit of Hebrew culture. He has questions unanswered about who he is. And he goes out there and he sees V'yayar b'sivil osam. He goes out and then he sees the construction site. We're told in source 11. He sees an Egyptian beating a Hebrew. He sees there's no one around, no one to take action. He kills the Egyptian, protects it. This is essentially where he decides who he is in character. He sees two Hebrews who are fighting, and he says, "Why are you hurting the other one?" Remarkable thing, and I mentioned this a few weeks ago, just this is such a sad observation, is he has this moment where, you know, according to some of the Mefarshim, was this moment where Moshe Rabbeinu was looking inside of himself. And he says, he looks this way to the Egyptian side of his character, and he looks to the Hebrew side of his character, and he says, "Who am I? Who am I really? Who am I?" And he sees he has not made any choices. He's been a hedge sitter his whole life. And finally he decides, "I'm going to kill the Egyptian inside me," essentially. Right? He's decided he's going to now become the Hebrew that he's always been had qualms about. And he you know, this starry-eyed, you know, altruistic individual, he's now identified himself. And the next day he goes on to the construction site, and he says, "I'm a Hebrew. Let me help you." And they said, "Who are you?" "Get it out of our makom, you know, who are you?" Like, what are you talking about? Why are you trying to resolve our problems? So it's such a sad moment in history where the Hebrews aren't willing to help. This newly minted Hebrew, in his own psychological sense, is being kicked out. But nonetheless, what's the hallmark of all of this? is he says, "Achein no adah hadavar." He says at the end of this, "Now I know. Now I understand." So what does that mean? So some of the Farshim, the Das Sekenim says, he's an Adadava was my murder yesterday, right? I just killed an Egyptian. He was a taskmaster. They're going to inquire after it. They're going to start looking for his fingerprints. Now they're going to see that it's related to me. So now I'm going to be on the wanted sign. I'm out of here. That's what the basic understanding is. Says the Malbim, quoting Chazal, no, Ochein Adadavar means that now I understand why it is that the nation of Israel are in Gadus. Now I know why you can't get out of this, because you keep fighting with each other and telling on each other. You don't have a sense of cohesion. You don't have a sense of care for one another. The only way to get out of this was for Moshe Rabbeinu to have the empathy for others. The reason they're not getting out of it is because they don't have that basic empathy for others. And that's where the two stories converge. Is this ability to be able to care for another person is the hallmark of what it means to be a free person. And missing it is therefore what brings them back to their doomed misentitlement as well. That's why the Midrash Gadda says in Source 14, "Vayar b'sivil osam." What does it mean that Moshe Rabbeinu saw their sufferings? Shoyaroyu bochem melachton. He was crying with their work. V'noisen kesefov al imkol echad ve'echad kedei l'sayam l'kach nema b'sivil osam. What did Moshe do? It wasn't that he was standing there, you know, smoking his Egyptian cigar, looking out on the platform above the construction site. He was pulling bricks with them. That's when it says Vayar b'sivil osam. You can't talk about it from an intellectual perspective. How many slaves are out there on the site right now? He was actually lugging with them. That's what made Moshe Rabbeinu the leader worthy of taking this nation out and sharing that middle with them, while they themselves were still blaming each other. That's what made a leader. You know, there's a fascinating story which is told about. Just want to make sure I have the name's correct. Very beautiful story that I heard a while back. About Rav Eliyahu Chaim Meisels, who was a rabbi in the community in Lodz in Poland in the 1800s. And, you know, in Eastern Europe was not quite as it is today. The heating was not the same. They didn't have boilers, and it was cold, and the winters were bitter. And he was the rabbi of the community, and he had certain responsibilities. So at a particular time in a bitter winter, we can appreciate it right now. We're in the middle of a bitter winter. Try to imagine, we had our boiler break just a month and a half ago during the coldest week then. So, you know, and you try to imagine what it's like being in a house like that. And it's not as if the ceiling is sealed, you know, and the little wooden door, which, you know, the hinges barely hold up. You can imagine what it must be like for people in those days, you know, in their one, two-bedroom houses, or maybe apartments. So the Rav decides there's a lot of people in distress, a lot of people in need. It's a particularly cold winter, and he decides he needs to go to collect funds to be able to help them. So he goes to the house of a fellow whose name is Isaac, who is a very wealthy individual, is a banker in town. He goes to the house. It's an early winter evening. He knocks on the door, and the snow is blowing, and the wind is blowing. And the valet comes to the door and says to him, "Sir," he says, "How can I help you?" He says, "I'm Rav Meisels. I'd like to speak to your master." And he says, "Absolutely, please come in." And he says, "No, we'll have a conversation right here." So in the meantime, the owner of the house sees what's going on. He runs to the door and he says, "Rav," he says, "the Rav comes to the door." He says, "Come on in. I have a hearth which is raging. I'll get you a cup of cocoa. Let's talk business." And the Rav says, no, we'll conduct business here." So he says to him, he says, "Look," he says, "I can't take it that you're sort of standing right here right now." He says, "Come into the house." He says, "But my boots are full of snow. I'll ruin your rug." He says, "You take off your boots, come on in." He comes in. He says, "Listen, there are 50 families in this community which I need to raise money for firewood. Please, can you pay for the money for firewood for these people?" He says, "Absolutely." And he says, but why did you make it so difficult?" He says, "Because you can't appreciate what it means to need firewood until you experience the cold for just a little bit, even for that little amount of moment." In fact, there was actually research which matches up with the Chochmah of Rav Meisels many years later, that there was a paper published in 2016 by Chen Wang, that was called "Experience Haptic Roughness Promotes Empathy," where they actually showed that people who had their hand, listen to this, who had their hand on sandpaper, right, were more willing to be generous of spirit than those who are not. Isn't that interesting? Just having a hand on sandpaper, because it's a rough experience, it's a rough exterior, and that experience of difficulty, so to speak, made them more empathetic to the cause that they're being asked about. Something as simple as that. Rav Meisels knew this in his blood, but they had to prove this in the 2000s through experimentation. But the notion is that when you're vayar b'siv losam, like Moshe Rabbeinu, when you have the willing empathy, that's how you can understand who they are, and that's how you can become the leader to get out of that. Another reason why empathy is just so important is because it's the necessary fabric which binds society together. I just read an article in the last week. Actually, the headline was more important than the article, and it was about how America remembers two different stories on January 6th. This has now been an anniversary of the January 6th riots in the Capitol, and everybody remembers those riots differently, which means to say that everybody has their own narrative. Nobody has the empathy to appreciate that there are other people with other perspectives. There's not a shared story, therefore, which is created by the empathy to hold the nation together. Empathy enables us to be able to understand that other people have different perspectives, have different struggles, and see things from a different standpoint. Without that empathy, it is very hard to imagine holding a nation together. Empathy is what binds families, neighbors, societies, and nations together. That's why it's such a prerequisite and an important ingredient of nationhood itself. And this explains one last point, and this is a remarkable idea that R.S. Sachs shares. And that is that at the beginning of the Seder, what do? We say in Aramaic, we say, Halach ma'anya, ti'achlo avasono debar de Mitzrayim, kol dich v'n yesa v'yechel, kol dich yesa v'yivsach. So he's at the beginning of the Seder, beginning of Maggid, that, you know, this is the poor man's bread, anybody who wants to come in. And it's a little bit of, you know, it seems like a little, we feel like charlatans a little bit, because, you know, really, who's coming in right now, right? You know, at this point in time, we spend, ages getting ready for the Seder, and we've worked out just the guesses, and we have little cards for everybody. Everything's just fine, right? Now we're going to, and more than that, it's like, what are you offering them? Halach ma'anya, right? Not the chicken soup, not the canedla, right? I'm not, no sinuations and gabrocks here, folks. But you know what I'm saying? You're not asking them. You're saying, take the poor man's bread, take the broken bread. That's what you should be taking in. What kind of offer is that? Right, Sachs quotes Primo Levi. Primo Levi wrote a number of books on the Holocaust. He was a Holocaust survivor himself. Very hard books to read. One of the books he describes is called "If This Is a Man," and he talks about how when the Holocaust camps were liberated, in this case by the Russians, what happened was is that the Germans, of course, you know, immediately as cowards ran away, and many of the Jews were left there, but many of the Jews were terribly sick. Some of them couldn't even stand up. So they made a deal that some of them would stay in the barracks, and the others of them would forage around because there was no food. It was the middle of a war, forget anything else. So there were those who went to forage, and they came back, and they brought whatever small rations they were able to. And he describes in Source 16, when the broken window was repaired and the stove began to spread its heat, something seemed to relax everyone. In that moment, Tarawowski, a Franco-Pole of 23 with typhus, proposed to others that each of them offer a slice of bread to us three who had been working. And so it was agreed, meaning to say, because those who had to stay back and work on the barracks and those who went out. Only a day before, a similar event would have been inconceivable. The law of the lager said, eat your own bread and if you can, that of your neighbor, and left no room for gratitude. It really meant that the lager was dead. It was the first human gesture that occurred among us. I believe that moment can be dated as the beginning of the change by which we who had not died slowly changed from Haftlinger to men again. Meaning when we were able to care for another person. When Elie Wiesel was in the camps and he was giving his soup to his father who was dying, there was one of the capos turned to him and said, take away his soup. You're not going to survive if you don't starve your father to death. That was the way that people survived. There was no, we can't even imagine what people went through. Says Primo Levi, the first act of freedom was the ability to share the broken bread. And that's what we do at the Seder. Halach ma'anya is the point in time where we reflect, what does it mean to be free? What it means to be free is to share broken bread. Yes, it may not be anything. Yes, it may be inconsequential. But when we say, we can share outwards, where we care enough about other people. That is the hallmark of what it means to be free. And that's the hallmark of what it means to be a part of the nation of Israel. Which is why it's so crucial that David HaMelech later on understood that and understood who were not part of it because of this as well. What a remarkable perspective. This, as opposed to the previous two ideas that we looked at. We looked at idea number one. 2 weeks ago was the need for morality. A week ago, we looked at the idea of a shared story. Those universal concepts. This is actually a particularistic concept. And next week, Mr. Shem, we're going to get to one other particularistic concept, and that is the concept of resilience as part of the nation of Israel, which is the foil to what we learned today. With this, we conclude, and there's obviously much more to talk about in this. Yes, Moish.
If David would have arrived at this tripartite criteria of defining Israel, if he arrived at that sooner, would he still have been so quick to hand over the seven descendants of Shaul or not? I didn't follow the sequence well.
So it's a good question. It seems that David HaMelech is saying that because I see that you're not willing to, That's why I will never in the future allow you to
right.
to
so
divide the nation.
That riches have been a part for him to arrive at. That's
correct.
The Suda.
That's what it seems like.
Aliyah,
correct.
There was a means for a time second. They were part of Christ over 400 years. They had that fundamental.
Correct. There's something and something had not happened internally in them. Exactly. Exactly. And that was what distinguished them. Rabbi Sai, thank you very, very much. Have a wonderful and meaningful weekend.